So Baruchim Habayim, welcome to each and every one of you. Let me put this evening in a bit of context and then dive right into our honored guests, which is we embarked on a journey a couple years ago now to work towards making Park Avenue Synagogue a center for national and global Jewish conversations, to take those issues which are on the Jewish docket, pressing, and try to understand them in Begadol, in the big picture, but also help those conversations inform our own congregational agenda. And so if you recall last year, for instance, we had a robust, active, exciting dialogue on Israel in the American Jewish imagination. And we talked about the emerging relationship between the diaspora and Eretz Yisrael and the state of Israel. This year, we took a look and continue to take a look at the shifting landscape of American Jewish life. And I want to just read to you the blurb on the pamphlet that we prepared, which asks the following leading questions. Do the institutions, ideologies, and denominations of American Jewry of the last century recommend themselves for the next one? Does the alphabet soup of the current American Jewish organizational life recommend itself to the Jewish future? Are the assumptions of American Jews today the same as those of past generations? If not, how, if at all, is the Jewish community adapting to these new conditions? And so this has been the theme of the year. And we have invited various scholars, historians, sociologists, musicians, leaders in philanthropy, talking about this anxiety we have as to whether or not the recommendations for the past are prescriptive for the Jewish present and the Jewish future, that Jewish identity is under threat, that centralized giving, the ADLs and the UJAs of the world are no longer operating the way they used to be, our seminaries, our denominations are on the wane, literacy is down, that somehow our Judaism is being watered down, the skyrocketing costs of Jewish education, and we're in the world of a sovereign self and of liberal individualism. Somehow we are watching a thick Jewish identity going into a very thin, paper thin expression of Jewish life and living, and it's this anxiety that we are trying to address. But in the midst of all this, I was struck by a passage that I was reminded of when we welcomed Jonathan Sarna and Robert Putnam in, which is the final passage of the tractate Sota in the Mishnah, which describes the same anxiety, right? The same concern of every generation. When Rabbi Meir died, there were no more makers of parables. When Rabbi Azai died, there were no more diligent students. When Rabbi Zoma died, there were no more expounders. This is in the famous essay by Ravidovich about Israel, the ever-dying people. And it explains that this concern that we have in our own moment, in our own generation, we need to ask, is it unique to us? Or is this not how Jews have felt, perhaps, at every stage, in every age of Jewish history? Was this not what an immigrant generation felt when they arrived on American shores? Was this not what Maimonides was concerned about when he saw the state of Jewish identity in his day? Wasn't this what Bialik wrote about when he thought of himself as Acharon Achronim, the very last of his generation. Wasn't this what Abraham himself thought when he thought he was going to die childless and everything would go to his servant Eliezer? So the anxiety is not new. But just because we can identify it with previous generations doesn't allow us to abdicate our responsibility to address it in our own generation. When it was Mark Twain who said that history never repeats itself, at best it rhymes. And I think what he meant by that, not in a Jewish context, is that we can appreciate our own moment in light of prior moments, but we need to appreciate our own moment in all of its particularities and its unique, what it brings to the table. We need to be able to zoom in to our own moment, but also zoom out at the historical arc to see the world with a microscope, but also with a wide-angle lens to understand the challenges of our own institutions, but also see that in the arc of Jewish history. And this is why we're welcoming the two individuals that we are going to have the honor of hearing from this evening, because Rabbi Dr. Ellenson and Rabbi Dr. Schachter, by their very titles, you sense that they are both students of the Jewish experience, but they are also invested in building up Jewish life here today, and most importantly, in the future. Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter is University Professor of Jewish History and Jewish Thought and Senior Scholar at the Center of the Jewish Future at Yeshiva University. From 2000 to 2005, he served as a dean of the Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik Institute in Boston. He was the first rabbi of the Young Israel of Sharon, Massachusetts, from 77 to 81, and created a vibrant community there, going on to from 81 to 2000 as a rabbi of the Jewish Center in New York City, moving the congregation from 180 to 600 members over the course of his tenure. And incidentally, when I was dating my wife, Debbie, and she lived on 82nd and I was at the seminary, that's where I'd go daven to. But that's not in your bio, unfortunately.
Maybe next time.
And has published prolifically, holding a PhD in Near Eastern languages from Harvard, it more than I can read, but a leadership role in many Jewish communal organizations and in the Orthodox world. We welcome you, Dr. Schachter. Dr. David Ellenson is the president of Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, and the I.H. and Anna Grenzel Professor of Jewish Religious Thought, internationally recognized for his publications and research in the areas of Jewish religious thought, ethics, and modern Jewish history, having received his Ph.D. from Columbia University in 81 and HUCJIR in 77. I think I went to the same elementary school as your children in Los Angeles, but beyond that, we'll have to find a point of identification. The most important thing I can say about these two gentlemen is this. It is one thing to be a scholar of the first rank. It is another thing to be a visionary and builder of Jewish life and living in our day and age. But it is a credit to both of them that they hold these two titles and attributes. But they're also just good guys. They're mensches. And it's to have two of them here this evening to be in dialogue on Jewish life and living, we are in for a treat. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Ellenson and Dr. Schachter. You want me here?
We want you wherever you want to be.
Okay, I'm happy to be here.
You always belong in the center. Dr. Ellenson is on your right, and I'm on your left.
Right.
So that's perfect.
It's a great way how to begin the conversation.
Okay, we forgot to do a coin toss. So why don't we do this alphabetically here, Dr. Ellenson? What we are going to do, we followed different formats over the course of the year. but we thought that given this opportunity, the best thing to do was to put these two gentlemen in dialogue with each other, and we'll. I have a list of some prepared questions, and then we're going to open it up for questions here. So let me start, Dr. Ellenson, and then I'll ask you, Dr. Schachter, the very same question, which is, I invited you here for the very reasons I just said. You are both students of Jewish history, scholars of the Jewish historical experience, but you are also institutional leaders in your own right, and you're invested in the Jewish future. So to the theme of the year, how would you characterize the present challenges and opportunities facing North American Jewry in light of what I just said? Are we in a moment that's fundamentally different than other? Dr. Ellenson, you wrote a book with the title After Emancipation. So oftentimes we periodize history as, you know, pre-modern and then post-emancipation. Is this a new era we're in, or just same old?
Okay, well, I want to express my gratitude to Rabbi Cosgrove for the very kind invitation to be here tonight. I will confess that I actually come here on occasion and hear Rabbi Cosgrove. I remember that the Shabbat, actually the Silvermans are here. I was very pleased to be invited to their youngest son's bar mitzvah. My wife and I were here, and it was also the same weekend that Prime Minister Netanyahu's father had passed away. And you're only supposed to tell miksad shivcho shel adam mishebefanav. You don't tell all of one's praises. But in case you at Park Avenue were not aware of this, Rabbi Cosgrove really carries his learning and his menschlichkeit and integrates them virtually effortlessly. And I will say that Professor Robert Chazen was also here that weekend, and listening to Rabbi Cosgrove talk about the work of Prime Minister Netanyahu's father, who was a tremendously great historian of the Sephardic Jewish experience, and combining it with themes in Torah and the challenges that confront our people today, there are not many people who are comparable to him. I only say not many. There may not be any that I'm aware of, but I'll at least say not many. And frankly, the opportunity to be here with Rabbi Schachter, I will say that one regret I frankly have about my own life is that the pace at which I have to lead it, and I know this is true with Rabbi Schachter as well, we simply do not get together as often as I would like, but we have been very good friends for many, many years. In fact, I'll tell one personal story and then I'll move on to your question. First time we met was about 22 years ago. I had been invited. I was a professor at HUC in Los Angeles, and his teacher, Professor Isidore Twersky at Harvard, used to have a seminar every year on aspects of Jewish modernity, and I had been invited to deliver a paper on the attitudes of a Hungarian Orthodox rabbi, Maharam Schick, towards reform. I do remember getting up saying, there are kind of two speeches I could give. One is really very short. Rabbi Schick did not like the reform movement. But then I said I can go on for 34 pages and describe exactly how he did not like it. But after all, I was from Columbia. Here I was at Harvard. Rabbi Schachter had done his doctorate there, and this will sound like a very, very simple act. And here I think of what it means for people just to perform acts of chesed and kindness. The reality was, at that point, I really didn't know anyone in the room very well, and there was a dinner afterwards, and Rabbi Schachter was sitting at the table, and he came up, and I cannot even describe the warmth with which he received me and invited me to come and sit with him at the table. And I know that from your standpoint, it was effortless, and I realize you weren't even conscious of probably anyone describing what you did as a tremendous act of chesed and hachnasat urchim, of welcoming guests in that occasion. But I knew from that moment on what an exceptional person you were, and the way you made me feel at home there is something that has served for me as a foundational moment in our relationship. So in addition to your scholarship and accomplishments, it represents for me on a personal level, as Rabbi Cosgrove put it, the menschlichkeit that Rabbi Schechter, I shouldn't say Schechter, but look where I am, Rabbi Schechter embodies, marks him really as a unique individual, and I look forward to our conversation this evening. I think in light of the points that Elliot made, and at this juncture, if it's all right, I'm going to actually use first names, but I don't mean that in any way to be demonstrate any lack of respect in any sense for Rabbi Schechter or Rabbi Cosgrove. It's actually kind of funny. All three of us are PhDs, and you know the line, in light of the advent of modernity, that Judaism became sick when rabbis became doctors, which actually says something about the age in which we live. I do think there are certain unique challenges. I think the introduction that Rabbi Cosgrove gave demonstrates that there is always a feeling of anxiety that marks people in every age. The concluding lines in Sota that he cited indicate that one always looks back to the past and understands that there is, in some sense, and I think many of us feel it, you read Data Dorot, there is a decline of the generations. Indeed, within classical Judaism, there is the notion that the further one is removed from Sinai, that there is a loss of greatness. Im harishonim hayu kachamorim az anu kivnei adam, v'im hem hayu kivnei adam az anu kachamorim. If our ancestors were like angels, then we're human beings, and in comparison to them, if they were human beings, then we're like donkeys. There is a notion that one looks back and sees previous ages as in some ways better. On the other hand, there is the halachic notion, hilchata kevatra'e. The halacha is always decided ka'achronim, according to the later, not the earlier authorities. The notion is that we stand on the shoulders of giants, and while we may or may not be as great as them, indeed seldom are we are able to, by standing on the Masoret, the tradition that we have, able to look at the challenges that confront us today in novel ways and look towards the future. I do believe that in this essay that Rabbi Cosgrove cited, that Elliot cited, written by Shimon Ravidovich, who was the first head of the Near Eastern and Judaic Studies Department at Brandeis, there is an essay entitled The Ever-Dying People, that the Jewish people have always perceived itself, in quotes, as always dying, and yet from Sinai until now, from Abraham and Sarah until now, our people have managed to meet the challenges of the ages in which we've lived, in large measure because God has graced us with da'at, God has graced us with knowledge and volition, and the acts that we take help to answer the challenges that we confront today. There is no question that there are issues that we confront that I would claim, nevertheless, are unique. If one were to look at the character of the Jewish people in the modern age over the last 200 years, there is no question that culturally we have a people that by and large knows much more about non-Jewish culture than Jewish culture, that religiously classical rabbinic doctrine, which affirmed the sanctity and holiness, revelation of the Torah at Sinai, of a Torah Shebichtav and a Torah Sheba'al Peh, written in oral law, has come to be challenged, and that socially, Jews have come to integrate into the larger world and to such a degree that we have record rates of exogamy, record rates of Jewish intermarriage. All of these, in one way or another, do have parallels, though in Jewish history, and I think the nature of the anxiety that we feel in the modern period, or even a postmodern period, is not absolutely unique. We do have a Jewish people today where more and more of our people are not thought of part of a thick, but I would say a thin Jewish culture, and that presents certain challenges. There is one issue that does make the modern period unique, And that has been the political transformation of our community. Prior to the advent of the modern world, to be a Jew was not only a mark of your identity, but it was also a sign, a designation of your political status. It meant that if you were Jew, you were part of a corporate group. Our community had powers of taxation, so that the political structure of the world in which we live was supported by a cultural matrix in which Jewishness was in many ways at the very center of Jewish life. For people like my grandparents, who all migrated here from Eastern Europe, parts of Russia and Poland and Romania, they went in many ways from a medieval to a modern world. Their Jewishness marked their political status in the world of their origins, and they came to an America that no longer compelled them to be Jewish politically. Having said that, though, their language was Yiddish. Their commitments to Zionism, to Israel, to Jewish observance were simply part of the whoop and wharf of who they were as human beings. By the time you get to the grandchildren, and now the great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren of these people, there is an attenuation in Jewish commitment and observance. And all of us who are in the kinds of positions that Elliot, JJ, and I are in are certainly cognizant of these kinds of challenges. There is something unique about the changes that our community confronts today, because what is actually new is this, is the reality that ours is a voluntaristic community. There is a wonderful, wonderful essay written by Gershon Cohen, the late chancellor of JTS, entitled The Blessing of Assimilation in Jewish Life. And what Professor Cohen shows in that essay, which was delivered as a graduation address at the Hebrew College in Boston in 1968, was that in every age where Jews have lived, they have been meshulavim b'tarbut. They have been acculturated. And they have taken from that culture, and by engaging in a process of Judaization, they have actually enriched the Jewish people throughout history. Now, the one issue, and I agree with that basically, and I think that's happened in America, but the one real difference is that with the weakening of the cultural and religious ties that many Jews feel, and with the collapse of our political community, the reality is that when a Maimonides brought non-Jewish Islamic culture into Judaism and enriched our people immeasurably in this way, the reality is that Maimonides and his compatriots were also very thoroughly steeped in Jewish tradition. There was a shiluv, an integration that they were able to attain. And I do sometimes worry, to be honest, about the magnitude of the challenges that we confront as a people. The last word I'd say in introduction, though, is that to keep in mind that even as we face the types of challenges of attenuation of identity, rising intermarriage rates, non-affiliation, what we have to also recognize that in North America today, more Jews are engaged in serious Talmudic study. There is an explosion of Jewish learning. There is a renewal of Jewish life. You have the reality of Limud conferences, and I could go on and on about all sorts of ways in which social media is now used to promote Jewish identity. What we have, I would say, and with this I'll conclude, are antipodean trends in Jewish life today. Remember, the antipodes on a battery are when the currents run in equal but opposite directions. To be fair, we are probably losing more than we are gaining, but there are pockets, and indeed large pockets, more than pockets, circles of Jewish renewal and commitment that give me great, great hope for the future, because I do not think that the quality of Judaism and its ability to speak to people in this age is contingent only on numbers. So that while I do worry about the nature of the world in which we live and what it will mean for my children and grandchildren as we move on into the 21st century, I'm also very confident and optimistic about the pockets of renewal that I see, more than pockets, the circles of renewal that I see, and the renaissance of Jewish life that also occurs in North America and throughout the world. The last point I would make, and I should have really begun with this, is however challenging the Jewish condition is today, one has to also consider that after 2,000 years where the Jewish people did not have sovereignty in our ancient homeland, the last 65 years have witnessed a miracle. Whatever the problems are in the state of Israel, I know that's not our major topic tonight, and I would be the first to acknowledge that there are problems. The rebirth of the Jewish state fills me with a greater degree of optimism and hope for the future of our people in Israel and throughout the diaspora, including North America, than any other single act. In that sense, if I were to think about the greatest events in Jewish history, from Sinai to the return of our people from Babylon to Israel, to the impact of emancipation, certainly the negative is the Holocaust, but the rebirth of the Jewish state means that we in our lifetime, I'm 65, have lived through some of the greatest moments in Jewish history that offer promise for the future.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm going to also say Elliot and David, if I have everyone's permission, as a sign of utmost love and affection and respect. I want to thank Elliot for the invitation to come to be part of this program for the year, and especially to be able to have a conversation with my beloved friend David. I've gotten to know Elliot over the last couple of years. This is my second time at Park Avenue Synagogue, and we've had some time together privately with our spouses around the table. And Elliot, I have such enormous respect for you, for the work that you have done academically, and in particular, for the kind of rabbi that you continue to be as a model of leadership for this community. This synagogue has always been a flagship synagogue in the conservative movement with very distinguished rabbinic predecessors. You have taken it to a new level, and the place is bursting. Your impact is extraordinary, and I think so many of your colleagues from all the various parts of the aisle see in you a wondrous example of what rabbinic leadership can accomplish in a community. I did not have the pleasure, I have not had the pleasure of hearing you Torah Sheba Al Peh, but every year you're so kind and gracious to give me your collection of sermons. So I admire that for two reasons. First of all, that they're so organized and they're so put together, and that there is support in the congregation to enable that publication to take place. But even more so, it's pretty gutsy for the rabbi to publish his sermon because he can't use it again. I am flabbergasted at a rabbi who shoots himself in the head by just making public fantastic sermons that I have read and enjoyed and learned from deeply, with the knowledge that it's now out there and he has to constantly be challenged to be creative. So for all of these reasons, Elliot, I not only physically look up to you, but also intellectually and emotionally look up to you. It's an extraordinary privilege to be here with David. We've known one another now for many years. The truth is that I don't really remember 22 years ago. I'm so glad that I did the right thing. And I think it jump-started a relationship. The fact that we sat together then and that we're sitting together now really speaks to, I think, some of the positive aspects of the contemporary American Jewish community. I've learned so much from you as a human being and as a scholar. You're gracious in sharing your books and articles with me. I've actually thought of one or two that I hope I'll be able to incorporate into our conversation this evening. You're a role model for wisdom, for human decency, for incredible integrity, and it's a privilege to share this platform with you. I want to begin with the Talmudic passage of Masechet Sota, since you started with it and you picked it up, and then I want to move on to a little bit more reflecting on the American Jewish experience. So there's this amazing Talmudic passage that immediately follows the Mishnah that Rabbi Cosgrove, that Elliot cited. The Mishnah says, to remind you, when this rabbi died, this was gone, and when this rabbi died, this was gone. And this notion of the ever-present anxiety about, so what's going to be, it's always greater in the past than it is in the present. So one of them is that when, I think it's Rabbi Meir died, humility was gone. Misha made somebody, batla anava. So the Talmud says, Amar Rabbi, somebody responds to that and says, what are you talking about? After all, veha ika ana. After all, I'm here. Sota 49a. What do you mean humility is gone? I'm a humble guy, and I'm still around. Now, obviously, that comment raises an extraordinary question, but I want to use it in responding to Eliot's, I think, very, very perceptive comment about the ongoing sense of anxiety within our community by saying that there's always this double-edged focus, that at the same time that we're bemoaning the sadness and the loss, somebody's actually saying, hold it for a second, I'm still around. Leaving aside the obvious lack of humility, the sense of there is a continuity, and there is a reality, and there is substance that continues even after this one or that one or the other one died. And I think that's really the blessing of our time in America, and I think it's also the challenge. In 1783, James Pettigrew, who was on the staff of General George Washington, came with pre-president, then General Washington, to Easton, Pennsylvania. And very shortly thereafter, a Jewish woman living in Easton becomes pregnant out of wedlock with a relationship with James Pettigrew. And the both of them, after she becomes pregnant, are married in a Christian ceremony. The following year, a fellow by the name of Barnett comes to the closest large Jewish community, Philadelphia, and testifies that somebody by the name of Moses Mordechai came to Easton and performed a Jewish marriage ceremony, uniting in a Jewish ceremony the Gentile Pettigrew and the Jewish woman. The community is very upset about this, and they don't know what to do. They call Moses Mordechai, and Moses Mordechai says that Barnett is ineligible to serve as a witness because he is a Sabbath desecrator and an eater of non-kosher food. So this one is saying that this one did something that the community thought was not so nice. The other one says, who is this guy to talk? He doesn't do appropriate things either. They don't know what to do. There is no rabbi in Philadelphia. As a matter of fact, there is no rabbi in the United States of America, and it was worth the price of admission just for this, to just realize. There were two rabbis who came in and out raising money for either Israel, Palestine, or Hebron, or communities in Europe. The first rabbi who came to the United States to stay as a rabbi did not arrive on these shores until 1840. His name was Abraham Rice, Rabbi Abraham Rice. He did not have a doctorate, and so he couldn't find a job in New York, and he had to become a rabbi in Baltimore. In 1784, 1785, there are no rabbis. There are two lay leaders of the Philadelphia community, Josephson and Carpalus, and they send a letter to a rabbi in Amsterdam, the go-to rabbi. What should we do? And I begin with this story, first of all, because it demonstrates that certain realities of the contemporary American Jewish community did not come to the fore for the first time in the 20th century. And second of all, because what they say in this letter, I think, is very instructive and helps put in perspective the issues that we're facing today. They write to the rabbi in Amsterdam, and they say, we don't know what to do. We are looking forward for you to tell us what to do. Especially, you need to understand that this country is not like the old country, because in this country, I'm going to say it in Hebrew and translate it, ish kol hayashar be'enav ya'aseh. You see, in this country, everybody could do as they please. We have no sanctions. We can't force anybody to do anything. So we need your advice. In a reality where everybody could do what they want, when there are no communal authority, either figures or mechanisms, just help us through how to deal with this one and with this one and deal with this situation. I'm more interested in the formulation in the letter, which is presently found in the archives of Congregation Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia. It was published in the 70s in an article in the Gratz College Journal of Jewish Studies, so it's available in print. It gives us a sense, and I want to begin in the American context, that the notion of freedom to choose has been part of the American experience pretty much ever since the beginning. However, I agree with David that things have substantially changed in the last number of years. I'm not good at giving a number to a number, but the last 40, 50, 60, 70 years, things have changed. And I want to frame the change in the context of a book that was published in 1985 entitled Habits of the Heart, subtitle Individualism and Commitment in American Life, by a then very prominent contemporary American sociologist of religion by the name of Robert Bellah, B-E-L-L-A-H. I believe it's in paperback. It's worth your taking a look at. Robert Bellah and three or four co-authors writes this book drawing attention to what he considers to be a growing phenomenon in this country, individualism and commitment in American life. Eliot, in his introductory remarks towards the end, used the phrase, the sovereign self. The phrase, the sovereign self, comes from a book that was published in 2000 by Arne Eisen, who's the chancellor of JTS, and Steve Cohen, who's now, I believe, on your staff, a very prominent sociologist, talking about in the absence of any loyalties, in the absence of any authorities, the authority is the sovereign self. And so to me, what I see as the fundamental issue that all of us who are gathered here this evening, who care about Jewish life in America, and who care about the continuity of Jewish life in America, for me, the fundamental challenge is, how can we construct a Jewishness? Sometimes it's Judaism, and sometimes it's Jewishness. How can we construct a Jewishness that people are going to choose to engage in? Because after all, we all know that the choices are endless. And if we can figure out a way that people should choose to be engaged, that is the key, I think, to the future of Jewish life in this country. I'm glad that David penultimate point was about the positives. And I cannot agree more. I think that we are living at a time where people are searching for meaning. The same old about the job and about the values, the culture. Very important, very central. But there's got to be more. People are looking to make their lives meaningful. And I think they're there. They're available. They're coming to this synagogue in droves because Eliot has framed a way of making Jewishness and Judaism meaningful. And I think that the communities that have an understanding of how to do that, I think ultimately are the ones that are going to be most successful. It's a great moment. And I would say, shame on us. Shame on us if we can't figure out a way how to engage this community. So on the one hand, it's always been this way. There have always been challenges. There have always been difficulties. They're compounded now with the multiplicity of available choices. But I think it's also a very precious very positive, precious moment in our contemporary American Jewish life that we should be giving and are giving substantial attention to, trying to address and to inspire.
Thank you to both of you. I'm wondering, I have a bunch of questions, but I would love to build on this, and I'm sure we will. I'm sure we will. Let me move to both of you. It's not lost on me that we have a Reform rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, a conservative rabbi. Your scholarship, interestingly, has been you, Dr. David, on Orthodoxy.
You can just call me your holiness. That'll
and so to you, JJ, you have studied Mordechai Kaplan and well beyond the bounds of Orthodoxy. And so as historians, but also as observers of contemporary Jewish life, denominations, one can tell the story, emerged all as different responses to the Enlightenment, the 1-2 punch of the Enlightenment emancipation, with the emergence of Reform, the modern Orthodoxy, the conservative movement somewhere in that narrative, whether that's in Europe or whether that's in America, the stories mirror each other somewhat. And I'm wondering just how true that is now. Meaning, if the last several hundred years of Jewish life, that the primary movers and shapers of Jewish expression have come out of Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, is that the case anymore, either for the individual Jew in the pew or from the broad structures of institutional life? Are these motivators like they once were? So I think we'll just switch the order. That's okay.
Sure. For me, the key question is, what is a uniter and what is a divider? What unites Jews in a common effort to tap into the circles of learning that David discussed and to engage them, and what divides us? I think that your average person in the pew is probably in a different pew or in no pew these days because they're not enamored by denominational labels. And I think that synagogues and institutions that do identify themselves denominationally are facing significant challenges, particularly within the middle, within the conservative movement, where there are so many developments that should belong within the conservative movement. But there's a reticence on the part of those who engage in them to denominationally identify. So I think we're facing a challenge in terms of labels. I don't think people today are interested in labels. They see labels as divisive and not as uniting. Even the notion of the sovereign self. Bella, in his book, actually uses the example of Sheila Larson. He talks about a young woman who is a nurse who named her own religion, and she calls it Sheilaism. And she describes her own religion. It's a little bit of that, a little bit of that. You love God, you're nice to people. Tomorrow you don't love God that much because you loved God yesterday. You got it out of your system, you'll come back to God. You know, it's a nice thing. You do whatever you want. And it's Sheilaism, Sheila Larson. He says this suggests logical possibility of 220 million American religions. There were 220 people living in America in 1985. You know that in the last couple of years, we've actually broken the 300 million mark. So we can have 300 million separate religions. She called hers Sheilaism. Her name was Sheila. Imagine what she would have called her religion if her name was Judy. But her name wasn't Judy. So we have Sheilaism. Sheilaism is directly opposite of denominationalism. And I would say, to the extent to which we can construct ways of respecting everyone's desire to help Jews engage in Jewishness and in Judaism as much as possible, that's the way to go.
You know, in thinking about this, I was trying to think about, in part, my own life. In my own life, I've lived in, as it were, several different worlds. I mean, I grew up in a small community, Newport News, Virginia, that had about 700 Jewish families among Peninsula. When I grew up in Virginia, in Tadwater, was about 250,000 people. I grew up in an Orthodox shul, had an Orthodox education as a boy, was active in NCSY as an adult, since Elliot mentioned some of the work of JJ, I became very attracted to the work of Mordechai Kaplan. I'm actually, even today, a member of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical Association. Without getting overly confessional, I actually am an Orthodox Reconstructionist. The same way people write to me occasionally complaining about the Zionism of Reform leadership today as a betrayal of the Pittsburgh platform, I have thought about writing to the heads of the Reconstructionist movement with their emphasis today on dimensions of Jewish mysticism, to say, what would Dr. Kaplan say about this? My children all attended Solomon Schechter schools. Indeed, my daughter Ruthie was in class with Rabbi Cosgrove. It's a little hard for me to believe right now. And I don't know, the second or third grade at the Akiba Academy at Sinai Temple. And of course, I went to Hebrew Union College. I have always had two heroes in the German Jews that I've studied, and I've spent most of my academic life studying German Judaism, because that's where the first struggles with modernity began in the way that we've talked about tonight. One is a rabbi who was an Orthodox or Gemeinde Rabbiner, an Orthodox community rabbi in Frankfurt. His name was Marcus Horovitz. Rabbi Horovitz was a graduate of the Orthodox Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary. And in 1895, when he was ordained, he had to write an essay describing what his vision of the rabbinate was. And he said that it was very important for him as an Orthodox rabbi to have a sense of what the integrity of Jewish tradition was, what the principles were upon which he stood. But at the same time, he said, he had to treat those who were his earnest opponents with absolute respect. He refused to take an Orthodox congregation that in the German structure was not part of the general Gemeinde, the general community, would not serve what in Germany were separatist Orthodox congregations. But a line that he wrote said that in his rabbinate, Ani rotzeh lehadgish ma shemeached otanu yoter mema shemafrid beinenu. As a rabbi, I want to emphasize much, much more what unites us as a people than what divides us, which does not mean that he did not take principled stances, but I've thought about Judaism as a kind of chain novel where each generation has to write its chapter, and I think the obligation that all of us have is to see what is it we can learn from every corner of the Jewish world. And in that sense, in light of what you asked, my other great hero is Rabbi Leo Beck, who was the last head of the German Jewish community under the Nazis. Rabbi Beck, who was unanimously elected by liberal and Orthodox elements in that community to represent the community during these terribly, terribly dark days, that doesn't even begin to describe it, of the Shoah, it has always interested me that the community did not select a businessman at that point to be its head, but it took a rabbi, a man quite literally of the spirit. Rabbi Beck often commented that he was opposed to an adjectival Judaism, where the adjective Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, Zionist, Secular was more important than the noun, Jewish or Judaism. And I think he had a very, very significant point there. The denominations arose, as Eliot just pointed out, as responses to this twin challenge of emancipation and enlightenment. Reform arose initially, the first response. Orthodoxy was a counter-response. Conservative Judaism, while ideologically its roots were in Europe, with Zacharia Frankel, was not a separate movement in Europe. In Europe, you had a liberal Judaism, meaning in Central Europe, and graduates of the Jewish Theological Seminary in Breslau, headed by Zacharia Frankel, who created the philosophy of positive historical Judaism with which the conservative movement is associated. I know all of you know that who are members of this congregation. Graduates of his seminary and graduates of Abraham Geiger, the Reform Jews Seminary, joined actually the same rabbinic organization in Europe. It was in America where, while there were very, very real ideological differences that separated the conservative from the Reform movement, there was also a sociological cleavage between Eastern European and German Jews. From a sociologist's point of view, I would say that Reform Judaism became the folk Judaism of the German Jews who were here, and conservative Judaism, by and large, became the folk religion of the Eastern Europeans who were here. Today, living in this world where religion is no longer, to use Bella's very felicitous title, a habit of the heart, those cleavages have by and large disappeared. For most of us, whether we come from Eastern European or German background, maybe a point of great historical interest means very little to Jews who live in America today. I do think increasingly Jews, though, do look for meaning. I mean, that's the key element. Another sociologist I'd mentioned, Peter Berger, two books of his that I'd mention here. One of his books is called The Heretical Imperative. What Professor Berger means by that is we live in a world where heresy is an imperative. Heresy points out the Greek etymological root. Heresis means choice or option. We live in a world where people have infinite options, and in a world of sovereign selves, it leads to Sheilaism. But another book that he writes is entitled The Homeless Mind. The Homeless Mind. And in The Homeless Mind, the point that he makes is that in a world where people have infinite options open before them, but people still seek meaning, people want to feel at home. People, I think, have innate spiritual needs. I think they want ethical guidance. I think they want the rootedness that comes from being part of a tradition. And the challenge is, how do we have, I mean, quite frankly, leaders like Rabbi Cosgrove to be able to present Judaism in this kind of way? I mean, we have people, you know, within all of our denominations. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke at Andy Backman's congregation, Beth Elohim. This is a congregation that 6 years ago had 300 families and was dying. Today, there are 975 family units, and I have no idea how many non-members come to this congregation. I cannot tell you precisely what Rabbi Backman does there, but clearly there are people in Brooklyn who were looking for the kind of meaning that he would provide, and we have this in many, many other places as well. I do think that people, I think among elite elements, people are concerned with denominational identification. I have been surprised how important it remains to many people, but it has clearly become attenuated. By the way, a study of the conservative movement shows if you actually want your child to be a conservative Jew, if that's important to you, conservative, you should send your child to Camp Ramah. Camp Ramah is the most successful socializing agency in the conservative movement. Of a longitudinal study that was just released of Ramah graduates, 70% as adults actually still identify as conservative Jews, with about 15% having become Orthodox and about 15% having become Reform. The problem is, it's literally about 7,000 people who were in this survey. It is a relatively small number, so you do have a movement, quite frankly, that has shrunk quite radically. And the same, to some degree, is certainly true, as our recent population study showed about the Reform movement. Denominations have incredible institutional challenges as we move ahead. And if we have more time, I'm willing to talk about what these denominational institutional challenges are. But I will say that I think as the 21st century moves on, the kind of institutional structure that we knew in the 20th century, reform, conservative, orthodox in North America, with strong institutions, YU, JTS, HUC, I am not certain that all of these institutions will remain as strong and vibrant as we move into the 21st century. I say that even as someone who spends all of my time and effort virtually, or a great deal of it, attempting to strengthen a particular institution. Though I will say, even from my point of view, the reason why HUC becomes most important to me is that I frankly see it as a clé, as an instrument for bringing, creating Clay Kodesh, I hate to call them Jewish professionals, holy vessels to go out and speak to the Jewish people so that Judaism can speak in meaningful cadences to Jews in the modern setting, so that I don't see an institution even like my own as an end in itself, but it really is a means to helping to plant seeds and roots of a Judaism which will speak in meaningful ways to Jews, so that this Jewish story and a sense of commitment to and obligation that springs from this story and from the God who stands as a major foundation of this story will be who our people will look to as we move into the 21st century.
So let me build on that, and then I'll open it up, which is this question of training of Clay Kodesh. You've both invested a huge amount of thought and time in rabbinical education and the continuing education of rabbis out in the field. And I'm just wondering, I actually just to reflect out loud, these have been incredibly, I don't want to say parv, but surprisingly non-denominational comments from denominational leaders. And so when you think about what tools you want to give to the students at YU, the students at HUC, as they go out on the field, what the landscape is, and also is if it's different than when you were going through your own training, what would be your reflections? Because it doesn't sound like it's that someone needs to be familiar with the founding documents of Reform Judaism or of Orthodox Judaism, or am I mishearing that?
You want to go first or me?
No, I went first last time. Okay. I'm happy to, but I...
It doesn't... I mean, listen... I am someone who teaches those foundational documents. I am quite committed to them. It's funny, I just taught a class today on actually a book that Danny Gordis and I wrote. I'm teaching a class on actually Orthodox rabbinical writings on personal status issues, responsa. But somehow something came up in the Reform movement and I was, Ben, I see you here, there may be other students. I was distressed to know that people could not identify the Hamburg Temple controversy in 1819, which was a controversy in which the Reform movement emerged. I just thought all of our students knew these things, and I'm going to have a discussion with our faculty about it later on. But having said that, I wouldn't say that I'm parva about, it isn't that I love denominations less, but I will say I do love the Jewish people more. That I really would say. And I am not Orthodox. JJ and I, on other settings, have talked about different theological beliefs, but I am much more committed to Judaism and the Jewish people than I am to a denomination per se. I do think sociologically, and now I'll just speak about my own movement, but I think some of what I say, frankly, would apply to JTS and the AJU and Hebrew College and the RRC. I do not think it applies to YU, quite frankly. And what I want to say is this. Most of our students who enter our school are products, and I'm saying this descriptively, of thin Jewish culture. By that, they may have gone to day school even for 4 or 5, maybe even 6 years. Occasionally, it's been really very lovely, both with Rabbi Lamb and with Richard Joel. I've been invited to come and speak with rabbinical students at Yeshiva University. For the most part, and I know there are exceptions, for the most part, these are people who are products of what I would call thick Jewish culture. They have not only gone, they have gone to day schools usually from the time they were 3 or 4 years old, 12 years of school, a couple of years in Israel, often, though not exclusively, Yeshiva College, but even if they've gone to a Brooklyn College or a Penn or Columbia or Harvard, they often study even during those years with the rabbi. They have deep textual immersion. I sometimes wonder with some of them, what are they going to do when they leave the greater New York metropolitan area? I think if I were teaching at Yeshiva University, the outreach program would be a great, great matter of concern for me. For students who attend most of the non-Orthodox seminaries, a number are graduates of day schools, and I don't want to say that they do not have, in some cases, strong Jewish knowledge when they come, but a great challenge that we confront is we have to provide them, in some cases, with elements of knowledge that they could have learned when they were 6, 7, or 8 years old. We have to get, and even the acquisition of Hebrew language begins for many of them at 19, 20, 21, 22. If you're asking me what's important about being a rabbi, the prerequisite for being a rabbi or a cantor is to be, or a Jewish educator, is to be a marbitz Torah. Has to be a person who knows and studies Torah. The only thing that authenticates a rabbi, the only thing that really makes Rabbi Cosgrove unique from all of you who are sitting here, is that he has Jewish knowledge, the knowledge that he acquired at the Jewish Theological Seminary, and then in addition, that was reinforced and enriched and deepened by his experience at the University of Chicago and studying the work of Rabbi Louis Jacobs and any number of major modern Jewish thinkers. Yesh lo mashu lagid, he has something to say. If you couldn't speak about who Netanyahu was and what his learning was, and able to combine that in a unique way with Torah teaching, what would it mean for you to be a rabbi? To be a rabbi, a person has to have Jewish knowledge, and therefore at the College Institute, I think the first prerequisite is to engage people and students and give them that level of Jewish, a level of Jewish knowledge that's required for them to be authentic as rabbis, to be genuinely rooted in the Jewish story. I also think a major part of our story for our students, and one of the reasons we have a required year in Israel, I am also a great believer that they have to have a sense of Jewish peoplehood. I cannot compel what their attitudes are. I can compel them to go to Israel and have a firsthand experience with the Jewish national rebirth and renaissance. And I can also demand that they go during their Pesach vacation to the former Soviet Union to work with remnants of our people, some vibrant, some not so vibrant, who were in the former Soviet Union. They need to understand that their journey is not a personal spiritual journey. It is that, but it is not that alone. It is a journey where they have to feel a commitment to Jewish peoplehood. If all they were Jewish studies scholars, if they saw their learning as Wissenschaft, academic study, and not Torah, would be a terrible, terrible disappointment to me. Having said all that, they do need professional skills. We require that they learn how to engage in counseling. They have to take pastoral care work. We do have now, through the Institute for Jewish Spirituality, a new program on all of our campuses where we talk about spiritual formation. When I was a rabbinic student, I will confess that with the exception of the classes taught by Eugene Borowitz, the G word was never mentioned at HUC, namely God. I mean, just wasn't. I think it's not a bad idea for rabbis to think about religion once in a while. And in fact, I think they need to think about their personal spiritual formation because the kind of community that they're going to be called upon to lead requires them to think about this along with sociological and other skills. I think it's important, you know, a lot of times people say, well, they need to know how to read budgets and rabbis don't know how to do fundraising. And I want to tell you, for the 5 or 6 years that I have them at HUC, And I am not opposed to them learning how to read a budget. When I became president of the college, I will confess, I was asked by the chairman of the board, could I read a budget? And I will confess that I said no. I said, I've never read a budget in my life. When I think back to 12 years ago, it's been a long journey. I don't even know what defined contributions were in a pension plan, which my finance chairman couldn't believe. And when we began, I was asked by one donor what the endowment of the college was, and I said, well, I don't have any idea. To which that donor responded, well, I'll say it was Harold Tanner. He said, you know, no one expects you to be an expert in finance, but if you're going to be the president, you should probably know what the endowment is. But I think those things can be learned, and I think they can be acquired, and I don't know that I want to take the time while I have these students in school for me personally to spend overly much time focusing on that in the curriculum. But in the end, I mean, here I just go to the Sephardic tradition. A rabbi has to be a marbitz Torah. Rabbi has to be a teacher. A rabbi has to be a chaver. Rabbi has to feel empathy with the people Israel, totally, and with individuals they meet. And then you hope that a rabbi has a little bit of, rabbi should be a chacham. I always think my father, when I used to do things, would go, tachas, David, tachas. But it's good for them to use a little bit of wisdom and when they go out and work. And so that, and I think all of these come to be parts of the education that, that our rabbis get. But I would say that in all the non-Orthodox seminaries, the need for enculturation. Enculturation means that someone is part of a culture, it's their legacy, it's their heritage, but they just don't know it. Enculturation is a major part of my aim at Hebrew Union College, and I don't believe, this is maybe my myth, I don't think that's as large a problem with the population you have at Yeshiva University.
I think it's really incredible and extraordinary when the president of Hebrew Union College talks about the role of a rabbi as being a marbitz Torah and about teaching Torah, learning Torah, studying Torah. I think it speaks to the incredible greatness of Rabbi David Ellenson. And it speaks to a moment in our contemporary American Jewish life where there is this commonality of values between various, we'll call them rabbinical seminaries. I am actually not really denominationally focused. For me, I come back to Bella, and I also want to come back to something that, one of the things that I learned from David in one of his articles. David was the first one in an article that he published a number of years ago in Modern Judaism that drew my attention to a 1975 article by, followed by the name of Carlin and Mendelwitz, where they talk about different kinds of authority. There used to be imperative authority, and now, 1975, I think the title of the article is What Does an American Rabbi Do When He Lost His Authority? Yeah. The focus now is on influential authority. The authority that a rabbi has, or an educator, or a cantor, or somebody who's trying to be a teacher in the community in some way, is there is no imperative authority. Nobody can force anybody to do anything, after all, the sovereign self. It is rather influential authority. So my goal is to try to be in a position, to some extent, to what I can myself, and then to train students to be influential authority producers, which means that they should be able, in their congregations and in their schools, to make Judaism so exciting and so special that they're going to be influencing people to choose to engage with it, because they can't force anybody to do anything. I think David is right in terms of the basic ethos of rabbinical students at my rabbinical seminary. They are just stellar, most of them, Talmidei Chachamim. They have gone through the thickness of the Jewish educational system, David, that you described. They continue to do that in rabbinical school. They keep on learning, keep on learning, keep on learning. But for me, the goal is, while they're in rabbinical school, and also I spend a lot of my time working with rabbis who are in the field. One of my major responsibilities is to run programs for pulpit rabbis who are already in the pulpit. See, the problem is with rabbinical students, as you know and you remember, you don't know what you don't know. You haven't lived it. It's just theoretical. And it's very hard to engage in a meaningful conversation with rabbinical students, and I try to do it all the time. And it's much easier to do so when the rabbi is out 2, 3, 4, 5, 8 years, when the rabbi knows that the rabbi doesn't know, because the reality of the world is such a complex one. And so therefore, what my focus is, and what I think all of our foci is to equip rabbinical students with the capacity, not just to have the knowledge, because in my case, they have the knowledge, but to, I would say, really genuinely care about engaging as many Jews as possible to share that knowledge. The challenge that I face is that there is, to some extent, some kind of an insularity within some of the students. They're very learned, very knowledgeable. I need to engage them in a conversation about the fact that their responsibility is not just within the Orthodox community, that they have a responsibility for the broader totality of the American Jewish community, that they have a responsibility to be involved with Federation, they have a responsibility to be involved and engaged in all of the various institutional structures of the cities to which they move, and that it matters to them, and that it needs to matter to them. And so I think the goal is to help inspire leaders to care about inspiring the members of their communities, congregations, and classrooms. For me, deep engagement with Torah and mitzvot is the most meaningful way for me to live my life. It's something that brings me great meaning. It's something that I submit to as a system because I believe that it's of divine origin. Some of it, a lot of it, needs to be defined over the course of time. But I believe that God gave the Torah to Moshe, and I believe that in that Torah are ways of life that, albeit difficult for me often, I am a product of American culture. I went to Brooklyn College and to Harvard University. I went to fancy universities. I very much identify with the liberal tradition of America. I feel blessed that I live in this country and am privy to and able to appreciate the multiplicity of values, including many of the isms that are so central to you are central to me. At the end of the day, I think that the notion of a tradition that is profound and strong, that I believe needs to be perpetuated, needs to have certain contours to it. And my job as an educator is to try to help students understand that on the one hand, there's a tremendous commitment to the tradition that needs to be perpetuated. But on the other hand, there's a commitment to make sure that as many people engage in it as best as they can, as much as possible. Just want to make one final point, and that is, there was a survey, a population survey of New York City, that recently, in the last year or so, came up with this extraordinary discovery that I'm not sure exactly of the numbers, I didn't have a chance to check today, but something like 64% of Jews in the New York area under 30 identify themselves as Orthodox. Something like that. Now, on my side of the tracks, there's a lot of, wow, that's really amazing. That's really amazing. Just stop for a second. In May of 1964, Look magazine ran a cover story entitled The Vanishing American Jew. And inside the article, it predicted the imminent disappearance of Orthodoxy. In 2012, 64% in New York City under the age of 30 identified themselves with Orthodox. What happened was Look magazine disappeared, but Orthodoxy somehow was around. Now, from my perspective, I'm very sad from my perspective, maybe we can have a conversation about this. Because, yeah, it's great, it's wonderful, wow. You know, and it is, it's great, it's wonderful. But what happened to everybody? What happened to the Jewish community? Where is everybody? Where's everybody's engagement? It can't be that in New York City, 64% under 30 identify with oil. It just can't be. And for me, it's a failure of Orthodoxy to engage in its responsibility to help engage all Jews in a measure of Jewish identity. I would love if everybody was Orthodox. It's not going to happen. I therefore love if everybody moves towards, in whatever way they can, a greater engagement with Torah, with Judaism, with Jewishness. That's what we need to do. And for me, it's sad that somehow the Orthodox community is not able to frame a Jewishness to the extent to which it might be possible to engage the greater numbers of the contemporary, even New York community. So my job, and it's different than when I was going to rabbinical school. I went to rabbinical school where I think I'm the only one in the class of 40 who actually became a rabbi. This was a real traditional yeshiva. We all studied Yoredeya, we studied Shulchan Aruch, we studied codes and law, and everybody went off to do whatever they wanted. I think I was the only one who actually went into the rabbinate, so it wasn't a classical rabbinical school with a full training. But in Yeshiva University today, the major effort on my part is to take these thickly educated Talmidei Chachamim and open them up to a language, a sensitivity, an appreciation of the totality of the world in which we live, the Jewish world in which we live, and to be able to frame language, concepts, ideas, and neshama, and heart that will be embracing and that will appreciate everybody where they are, to try to bring everybody one step closer to a meaningful engagement with Jewishness and with Jewish tradition.
If I could just conclude with the following moderator's prerogative, which is the key for me all the way through and to this day, in terms of developing rabbinic leadership, is that very early on in my own training, the gifts of the University of Judaism, the gifts of Machon Schechter, the gifts of JTS and other institutions of learning, is to find yourself a role model. And to look at individuals in your given profession, and I alluded to this in my remarks on Shabbat, that people who you admire. And now I went to the Jewish Center because the girl I was dating lived a few blocks away. But I know that I sat through every drasha that Rabbi Schechter gave, saying to myself, if I could preach or teach or build a community the way that he has and did, then that would be a fine rabbinate. And I remember the moment where I drew the courage to approach him and say, how do you give sermons? And he explained to me how the H and how he does it. And then I remember when I started writing on my doctorate on Louis Jacobs, and I said to myself, if I could, I didn't have the pleasure of a personal relationship, but if I could do to Jacobs what Dr. Ellenson did to Hildesheimer, with the clarity of thought and the depth of scholarship, I said that would be a pretty good contribution to intellectual history there. And it is seeing models like the gentleman to my left and to my right, and now I have the good fortune of being able to sit on a podium with them and count them as friends and colleagues. But that, for me, was a gift of my training, and I hope you can see now why I consider both of them my teachers. Thank you so much for being here.